Lecture 5. Drakon of Athens and the Birth of Greek Law.
Welcome back. In Lecture 3, we discussed a number of tyrannies that came about because of unrest with ruling aristocratic families. Now, the word aristocracy comes from the Greek aristoi, meaning the best men. But while they might have thought of themselves as best, the mass of the ordinary people evidently didn't. Perhaps that relatively new class of society, the hoplite soldiers, had a hand in bringing about the changes of regime. And if the hoplites in other places could do this, then they certainly could in Athens, given the unrest and the civil distress that was rampant throughout Attica. In this lecture, we're first going to talk about the attempted tyranny of Cylon in the 630s, and then second, we're going to talk about the codification of the laws by Drakon in the 620s BC. Now, in the 630s, most of the books say 632, but how on earth can we be that specific in this early period? An Athenian man named Cylon seized the Acropolis. He was married to the daughter of Theagenes, the tyrant of Megara, and he actually received support from him in the form of soldiers. Now, it's unknown whether Cylon was trying to set himself up as tyrant, or whether Theagenes was using his son-in-law in some way to launch a takeover bid on Athens. I don't buy that second theory at all, and I can't see any other reason for Cylon's move except to set up a tyranny. Now, we don't know a great deal about the episode because of limited information. Once again, our sources are fairly bereft in the details. Apparently, Cylon received word from the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi to seize the Acropolis, the citadel of Athens, because whoever controlled that got control of the city. Once again, we see the role of religion in political life. The oracle told him to take over Athens. Well, Cylon did so. He and his supporters did seize the Acropolis, but they were soon besieged by the Athenians. As the siege grew protracted, the archons decided to starve Cylon and his company into surrender. As many of his supporters died from lack of food and water, Cylon and his brother managed to flee Athens. We don't need to worry about those two anymore. But his supporters were less lucky. They fled to the sanctuary of Athena, which was before the Acropolis, fleeing there for sanctuary, for safety. But when some of them started to die there, and so that meant they were polluting the temple, the archons promised them safety if they surrendered. You see, dead bodies pollute temples, and as a result, they offend the gods. And since the safety of the city lies with the favor of the gods, the archons had to do something quickly to salvage the situation. Well, the men in the temple had little choice but to comply. They had to surrender. They were starving to death. But just to be on the safe side, they tied some type of rope to themselves and to the altar of Athena, so that technically they were still attached to it and so protected by the goddess. Apparently, as they left the sanctuary, the rope broke. Now, whether it snapped of its own accord or whether someone outside cut it is unknown. But once it broke, the archon Megacles, a member of the powerful Alcmaeonidae family, gave orders that the men were to be murdered. And they were. Now, the Athenians at the time don't seem to have been too bothered by what happened. But the killings caused a rift in relations between Athens and Megara, given that some of the murdered men were sent by Theagenes, the tyrant of Megara. At some later point, the Athenians decided that Megacles' action was blasphemous. It involved Athena, and even though the rope had broken, there was still that breaking of sanctuary. The promise had been made to them that they would not be harmed, and they'd been put to death. Now, the fact that Athens and Megara were at loggerheads with each other would also have been a factor in this decision. So the Alcmaeonidae, as a family, were put on trial. Megacles must have been dead by then because there's no reference to him in the sources. They were prosecuted by a man called Myron, and this is where what we have of the Athenian constitution, that treatise attributed to Aristotle that I talked about last time, this is where the Athenian constitution begins. Now, the Alcmaeonidae were cursed and they were exiled from Athens. According to the Athenian constitution, even the bones of the deceased family members who had been responsible for killing Kylon's supporters were dug up and thrown beyond the borders of Attica to make sure that the whole of Attica was pure in the eyes of the gods. Well, the Alcmaeonidae did return to Athens at a later date, but this curse plagued it for generations. It was used to great effect against them even centuries later. So Thucydides, our contemporary source for the Peloponnesian War, tells us about the Kylon incident to explain why in 432, that's the year before hostilities and the Peloponnesian War broke out, and as war loomed on the horizon between Athens and Sparta, Thucydides tells us that the Spartans sent an embassy to the Athenians, asking them to expel those cursed of the goddess. Now, Kylon had been a victor at the Olympic Games of probably 640. And so even a decade later, in the 630s, he was able to use his household name like other tyrants had to seize power. Perhaps he failed in his attempt to become tyrant because his father-in-law was Theagenes, the tyrant of Megara. He'd sent him troops, remember, to support his bid. And if this was a factor, then I find it interesting because it shows us that even though the people were suffering, as we know they were, and even though they knew a tyrant's rule was generally beneficial, they couldn't overcome their xenophobic nature. Now, after Kylon's expulsion from the city, the Eupatridae must have met to decide what to do. Remember, the Eupatridae are the super aristocrats, if you like. They're that narrow blue blood ruling family that exercise power in Athens. So we have aristocrats, and then we have the super aristocrats. Now, a large number of small farmers, as we know, were hectameroi. They were in debt to their aristocratic neighbours. They probably lost their farms by now, and they were being enslaved. So, needless to say, there would have been much unrest. There was also discontent from the middle stratum of society, the hoplites, because they were denied the chance to take part in the political process. For them, that meant attending the assembly or standing for office, one of the archonships. And we talked about those last time. Now, the last thing the Eupatridae, that's the ruling families, the last thing they wanted was to see their own power come to an end. Because with this fusion of economic distress and social and political discontent, they realized that they could face severe problems. Because these sorts of things had happened elsewhere, and they had given rise to tyrannies. So presumably with this in mind, in the 620s BC, they appointed a man called Drakon to codify the laws. Now, the date given in the Athenian constitution for this is in the archonship of Aristaechmus, and this works out at 621. Because we have fragments of the Archon list, and we can trace Aristaechmus to this year. Now you're probably saying, what's an Archon list? And the Athenians started to keep a register of all their Archons on an annual basis, so they could trace back to a particular Archon to find out how long it was since a certain piece of legislation had been passed, or a law, or something like that. Now, we actually have fragments of that Archon list. And so Aristaechmus's name is there, and we can track it back to 621. That's why I think we're reasonably safe in dating Drakon to that year. Now, we've got no idea how Drakon was selected. Obviously, the Eupatridae decided he was to do this job, but whether his name was put forward by the Areopagus or by the archons, or even the two of them working together, is unknown. We also don't know a lot about him, and his name gives little away. In Greek, the word drakon means a dragon, or more usually a snake. Now, sometimes names reflect a physical characteristic. For example, one of Alexander the Great's generals was called Antigonus Monophthalmos, Antigonus the One-Eyed. Now, this is pretty self-explanatory. Monophthalmos, the word monos means single or alone, and ophthalmos means eye, hence ophthalmology. So Antigonus had one eye. What about Drakon? Well, presumably, he didn't go around breathing fire or slithering from place to place or talking the sort of parcel tongue of Harry Potter. But if his name was meant to conjure up something, well, it's hard to guess what. If you have any ideas, email me. And I mean that. Look up at my email address. I'm always willing to have emails and answer them. Given the harshness of his laws, though, it's possible that his name had something to do with the snake's bite. Once you got bit by the snake that was deadly, you died. Because if you remember, Drakon made the penalty for almost every crime death. So that's what I think. Now, we should bear in mind that Drakon did not invent anything that became law as such. Law existed in Greece before this period. However, it was more of the American Wild West style of justice, of shooting first and asking questions later. If two people had a dispute, say in the Bronze Age or the Dark Ages, and Homer tells us about this, then they resolved it by fighting. They duked it out. So if someone stole a sheep, he could be beaten or killed. And we can understand that because the crime had economic consequences, just like cattle rustling in American history. Also, law before Drakon was a family affair, in the sense that if somebody were killed, the family would seek revenge on the murderer or on that person's family. But they had the right to seek this revenge. They didn't just do it off their own accord or some sort of vigilante style. They had the right to do this. And so we get the origins of blood feuds that could last for generations. We'll discuss these aspects of the law code and its development further in Lecture 35, by the way. Now, what Drakon did was to begin the process that gave rise to the formal system of law and procedures, courts, trial by jury, the right of appeal, and those other things we take for granted today. He began it all. And he did this by laying down penalties for crimes and by taking the personal element out of seeking revenge and making the state responsible. In this respect, it's not going too far to call Drakon the father of Greek law. So we're meeting a lot of fathers in this course, aren't we? And we've got a heck of a lot more to meet yet. We don't know exactly what Drakon did, since the Athenian constitution has next to nothing on him. And what it does tell us is hazy, and the details are wrong in many respects. They imply that he established a complete set of laws. Now, we know he didn't do this. This was something that came about only later, even after the time of Solon. And that's, of course, 594 BC. More information about Drakon comes from Plutarch, who in the 1st century AD wrote a series of biographies of famous Greeks and Romans down to the end of the Roman Republic. He wrote a biography of Solon, and in it, Plutarch tells us that Drakon made the penalty for almost every offence death. So the crime itself didn't matter. As Plutarch says in his account of Drakon, you could be killed for stealing vegetables or fruit, for robbing temples, for murder, or even being idle. So imagine if we had that penalty today for being idle. The world population would drop down to 3.5 billion. Well, this sounds a bit extreme to me, execution for almost every crime. And Drakon's penalties were not likely to curry much favour with the people, because you were going to be put to death for whatever you did. It didn't matter. His name, of course, gives rise to our word draconian, that means anything severe or harsh. And Plutarch adds a charming little anecdote that the Athenian orator Demades, who lived in the later 4th century, said that Dracon wrote his laws not in ink, but in blood. Plutarch goes on to say that when Dracon was asked why he proposed death for almost everything, he said that he thought small offences should be punished in this way, and that he knew of no greater penalties for bigger offences, therefore everybody should die. Clearly then, Dracon was trying to introduce some sort of ultimate deterrent in an effort to bring stability, law and order, to Attica. He may also have introduced the law about the amount of interest to be repaid on a debt, which gave rise to the hektameroi. Remember, those who had to repay what they borrowed plus 1/6 of their produce as interest, because the word hektamorion means 1/6. Since we're told in the Athenian constitution and elsewhere that these people resented the law about debt, it seems plausible to conclude that Dracon made some contribution to the system of borrowing and debt repayment. Maybe he standardized the interest rate. Now, 30 years later, after Dracon, Solon would address this law, so it was clearly in existence by his time, by Solon's time. And Dracon is the only person who could have introduced it. Bit of a heresy here, but let's run with it anyway. Now, Dracon's legislation was a significant advancement in the legal rights of the people. Before his time, the aristocrats were the ones who meted out justice, and there was no penalty laid down for crimes. Justice handed out on a personal whim of the aristocratic rulers was resented by the people. It would be today. And it has to be resented, otherwise why would Dracon codify the laws? So he changed the system by taking out the personal or arbitrary element of the law as far as any punishment was concerned, and he replaced it with the objective. Everyone was now theoretically subject to the same penalty. Everyone was equal in the eyes of the law, just as is the case today, unless, of course, you have lots of money. Now, equally important was Dracon's law on homicide. He took responsibility away from the family's obligation to seek revenge on murderers and made the state liable for this. In other words, the state, the entity, now became responsible for both premeditated and unintentional homicide, where previously the deceased person's family had the right to seek revenge. And needless to say, this brand of justice was grim, as the family would also be out for blood. And families would often take the life of the other person who killed one of their own number. Now, thanks to Dracon, it seems that the fratri, which is usually translated as brotherhood, and it consists of a number of families. It's not like an extended family. You've got to imagine a number of families that form a unit, a brotherhood, and this is called the fratri. Now the fratri, not the individual family, gets to decide the penalty. And in the case of premeditated homicide, it was death. In the case of accidental homicide, exile. And you see what I'm getting at here. The individual family would want blood, but the fratri, which consisted of that family plus others, so the others were not that intimately affected by the deed, might judge things differently. Now, obviously, what Dracon did has its flaws. But if we step back for a moment, we can see how important he is in the development of that legal code. First, he took away the arbitrary dispensation of justice. And in doing so, for the first time, he put some limit on the powers of the Eupatridae, at least as it affected their judicial abilities. Now, they could no longer decide the penalty willy-nilly, and hence impose a punishment that was too harsh on someone they didn't like, or too light on someone they did like, for example, a member of their own class. Second, families could no longer kill in revenge. They had to bow to a new process of the fratri evaluating homicide. And third and final, and this is what is really, really important. Well, everything's important, but this is really important. For the first time, the laws were written down so that everybody could see them. Now, Drakon's laws were inscribed on what were called axones, or wooden blocks, with four sides and writing on each side, and they were set up on poles. So these axones could be turned so that each side could then be read. It's rather like looking at greeting cards or birthday cards on one of those display stands today. You turn the thing around so you can see all the cards on that stand. That meant that back in Athens in the 620s and following now, you could see the law. So nothing was hidden or unknown anymore. Nothing was arbitrary anymore. Well, you might be saying, well, this is great, this is fantastic. But whether you could read the thing is another matter. We're still in an era when there was a high degree of functional illiteracy. The vast number of people could not read. They had to rely on the literate few to read for them. And of course, you can see the flaw there. Someone who can't read, that person could be told anything about what's written on a page. Well, Drakon's laws were repealed by later lawgivers, beginning with Solon. But apparently his homicide law was retained in Athens throughout the classical period. In fact, in 409, the Athenians were supposed to have taken his homicide law, and by then it would have been re-inscribed on stone rather than left on the original wooden axones, because they would have perished. And the idea was in 409 they were going to re-inscribe it, or re-inscribe it by then, on a new stone. And we have it. That inscription survives. Like many others, it's in the Epigraphical Museum in Athens, which is a huge repository of Greek inscriptions. There is a downside. There's always a downside. Whether it's a faithful copy of the original Draconian law of 621 is unknown, because there were additions and amendments to that law over the years. So there's no guarantee that in 409, the Athenians could separate the original from the amendments. Nevertheless, we have what we have, and that's far better than not having it, isn't it? Now, it's interesting, at least it is to me, that in the aftermath of Kylon's attempted tyranny, with all these socioeconomic grievances going on, the hoplites probably badgering for political change, it's interesting that the Eupatridae decided to appoint Drakon to address legal rights. It doesn't look as if the people were clamoring for these, does it? They wanted things like a redistribution of their lands. They wanted an end to the debts. The hoplites may well have been wanting political rights. Nobody's talking about law here. But the Eupatridae were doing nothing about these issues. Did they misjudge the situation and think that having someone establish the first written law code would quieten the people? Did they really think that the middle stratum of society, which perhaps is more interested in political rights, would be content because there was now a fixed penalty for virtually every crime? It's hard to believe that all of a sudden people who were starving or being sold into slavery would suddenly start running around with smiles on their faces and ending their discontent because somebody decided that virtually every crime was to be punished by death. Dissension, of course, continued. And by 600, the plight of the poor in the countryside was ushering in a period of civil war. And it's not a surprise. We need to step back for a moment and just think about what life was like then. It's very easy to keep talking about how badly off the people were, how the people were facing starvation. And in the process, the neutrality of the term people anesthetizes us to the situation. But history is about people who used to be alive, had feelings, had emotions, had families, and who worked hard and spent family time together. If we close our eyes and take ourselves back to this time, actually try to imagine what was it like to be a struggling farmer back then, we get some idea of how terrible life was. I mean, imagine your land won't support the crops you need for your family. You see your land seized, your family starving, and then even worse, you see your family sold into slavery. Gone is the family time, you're never going to see them again. And the Athenian Constitution vividly states that for the mass of the people, I'm going to quote here, the harshest and most grievous aspects of the Constitution were their being enslaved. Yet the ruling families didn't care for you. They were more concerned with their own power. And even worse, what little corn that there was grown in Attica, they were exporting on foreign markets for big profits. The only way out was if this current regime were toppled. In other words, if a tyrant came to power, a tyrant who would improve your situation as the tyrants elsewhere had done so. And everyone knew about tyrannies in other places, word travels. And let's not forget that Kylon had been supported by Megara. So everyone knew that tyrants had come to power in other places and actually done a good job there. So why not in Athens? Well, there was no tyrant in Athens at this time to make things better. Kylon had tried a tyranny back in the 630s, but he'd been quickly booted out. And besides, you know, that was 3 decades ago by now. And there was nobody else that had come along since then. So enough was eventually going to be enough. If the only way out to topple the existing regime was by civil war, then so be it. And that's what happened. So the socio-economic problems of the people turned political. And the Athenian Constitution tells us that civil war broke out and that it lasted for quite some time, with the masses rising against the nobles. And so faced with that scenario, the Eupatridae made an Athenian man called Solon extraordinary archon in the year 594. In other words, they suspended the other 3 archonships and they made him extraordinary archon. He was given full powers to fix the situation, to end the civil war. Now, in this respect, we should give them, that's the Eupatridae, I think we should give them a pat on the back because they were trying to do something about the situation. They were trying to fix it. They weren't trying to fix it, of course, for the betterment of everyone, for the betterment of the ordinary people. They were trying to fix it so they wouldn't be toppled, so that civil war would go away. Now, who is this Solon? Well, we don't know a lot about him. You've probably cottoned on by now that we don't know a lot about many things, at least in this early period. It will get better, I promise. Solon was an aristocrat. The Athenian Constitution says that he was by birth and by reputation one of the top class. He was also, by wealth and position, a member of the middle class, which means that he may have also indulged in trade. So he seems to have been an aristocrat by birth who also engaged himself in trade, who got his fingers in the trading pie. And this straddling of 2 strata, 2 classes in effect, made him acceptable to both sides. Both sides could trust him. The aristocrats could because he was one of their own. The people could because he seemed to identify with them. Therefore, he was appointed extraordinary archon to mediate in the troubles affecting both sides of society. However, Solon makes it clear in the fragments of his poetry that survive that he blamed the rich for the plight of the poor and the chaos into which Attica had fallen. He makes it very clear who's to blame. He criticizes the rich, the aristocrats, for their ambitions, how they acquired all their land at the expense of the poor. Remember when the hectameroi went further into debt? His, that's the small farmer's land, was seized by the aristocrats. So they acquired more land, built up even bigger estates. And Solon also warns the aristocrats that things are going to change. Well, my goodness, things change. Don't they ever? And we're going to see just how revolutionary those changes are in the next couple of lectures. See you then.